Hello, everybody. This is a bit of a different episode today. This is the recording of the first ever Cosmic Shed Live. We did it at Bristol Planetarium in September 2016. It was partly to celebrate 50 years of Star Trek, and it was partly to raise money for charity. And in the end, we raised, I think it was £938 for LGBT Bristol and SARI. Thank you so much to everybody who came along. It was great to meet so many of you, and we'd all just watched Star Trek The Wrath of Khan at Bristol Planetarium, and we settled in to have a chat about that and the science of Star Trek more generally. I hope you enjoy it.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the way science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
Hello and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And we're actually at Bristol Planetarium at the moment. Hello, everyone.
Hey.
Did you enjoy the film?
Yes.
It's good. Have you seen it before?
Yes.
Oh, right. Why'd you come again? So, as I say, I'm Andrew, and with me today are...
Steve.
And...
Maddie.
And...
Ty.
And I'm delighted to say that we're joined by two guests, one of whom is new to the Cosmic Shed, and that's Toshna Komisariat, who is a reporter for Physics World.
That's right.
And a massive Star Trek nerd, so we thought we'd get her along. And... Professor Bruce Drinkwater, sorry.
Hello.
Who is no stranger to the Cosmic Shed, having been
there all the time.
Yeah. He's first joined us for our episode on Doctor Who, because Bruce not only has invented a sonic tract beam, but a sonic screwdriver. How cool is he? we'll come to that later on. Actually, I think we might actually start with that, because there was something in that film that was a little bit like a sonic screwdriver, wasn't there? Or your sonic screwdriver.
Was there? Remind me.
there was a scene with somebody on a table, and there was a doctor who was holding something in his hand that seemed to be interacting with somebody without touching them.
Yeah, I suppose, yes. So, I mean, actually, I'd say that's more like the tractor beam. In a way. But, I mean, one of the things we think tractor beams could be useful for is moving things around within people.
Yeah.
I mean, So you'll see it's quite a long way from doing that at the moment, but hopefully you'll get the idea that the scale's not a million miles off, and the forces that we're generating on things are not a million miles off either. So,
Star Trek been an inspiration for you to get into science, Bruce?
I'm not sure to get into it, but certainly tractor beams have always, the last few years, have been going around and around in my head, and that's very much Star Trek influence. So it's kind of come back again. I think it went away like those worms or whatever they were that got inside their heads, kind of lodged itself in my head, and the last few years it's been coming out again. It's probably for the best. And that's the product.
Maddie, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, hi everyone. So I'm a nanoscientist at the University of Bristol, and Bruce is actually one of my supervisors. So I use ultrasound in trying to make really cool, exciting new materials. That's pretty much what I do.
Cool. That's good. Steve?
I work in the Faculty of Engineering. I'm a teaching fellow, so I teach lots of engineers across a few different departments. And I'm just finishing a PhD in Dynamics and Control, in which I make giant robots pretend to be aeroplanes so we can test control systems and stuff. It's very good fun.
Is Star Trek any kind of inspiration for you?
Yes, it is, but I'm not sure which way the causation goes. Are nerdy kids into Star Trek, or does Star Trek make kids nerdy?
Yeah.
There's definitely a correlation there for me.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, we're going to talk about the film, aren't we? So, Ty, go on. Tell us something about the film that we don't already know.
Oh, my God, the film. yeah, I have no science background, but I just run Bristol Sunset Cinema, and I'm just a big Star Trek nerd, so I think that's why I'm on the panel. So, the film was made in 1982, and it was a follow-up to Star Trek The Motion Picture, which Paramount had decided to make because a small little science fiction film called Star Wars had done quite well at the box office 2 years earlier, and they were like, oh my God, what science fiction properties do we have that we can then just launch and make lots of money? So they did Star Trek, The Motion Picture. They got in Robert Wise, who had done The Day the Earth Stood Still and The Sound of Music, a natural choice. And he did a film that was very grand in scope, and some might say slow in pace. There's a reason why its nickname is Star Trek the Slow Motion Picture. It made its money, but let's just say it wasn't particularly beloved by critics and audiences alike. So they needed fresh blood, and they brought in Nicholas Meyer, who had previously directed a film called Time After Time, which is about H.G. Wells fighting Jack the Ripper. It's pretty cool. And he wasn't a Star Trek fan at all, but he was a big fan of Horatio Hornblower. And after meeting producer Harve Bennett, and Harve Bennett realizing that they needed a script very quickly if they were going to make the studio launch date, Nicholas Meyer knocked out a script in 12 days. And he wasn't a Star Trek fan at all, but he had met producer Harve Bennett, and they watched all 79 episodes of the original series and realized that the episode Space Seed, where you first meet Khan, would be the perfect launch point for a film. So Harve Bennett gave Nicholas Meyer his orders. Nicholas Meyer went away, wrote the script in 12 days, essentially made it a fun action adventure with all the naval elements that he loved from Hornblower. Leonard Nimoy didn't really want to return, and then only agreed to return if he died. This caused this leak, and this caused the original fan outrage. There were letter writing campaigns, how dare Nicholas Meyer kill Spock, what is he thinking? Letters upon letters upon letters. At the moment, Nicholas Meyer is also in trouble with Star Trek fans because at a recent convention he said that Star Trek fans often don't know what's good for them. And, you know, after Star Trek II, you would have thought that they would give him a little bit of slack. But no, again, Star Trek fans, we're a passionate bunch. Want to, you know, lynch him. Daring to think that, you know, he might have a good idea. But anyway, he delivered the goods. Star Trek II was a big hit. And it's beloved as one of the best Star Trek films to this day. That's the short version.
Okay. That's a good version, thanks.
I have a question. Ty might be able to answer, or Andrew definitely might, because I know you've spent the last month watching pretty much every single episode of Star Trek. So there's a few continuity things that I'm struggling to piece together in my head. So in the new set of Star Trek movies, then there's old Spock, yeah?
Mm, yeah.
So how does that work with Spock dying in here? Because I haven't watched everything in...
You've not seen Star Trek
3,
then?
Have they retconned it into...
Hmm? You haven't seen the next film, Star Trek 3, The Search for Spock.
I don't remember Star Trek 3.
Let's just say Spock comes back.
fine, okay. Sorry, guys.
He's fine. And then he gets older. And, yeah, it's fine. Yeah, okay. It's all good.
Toshda.
Yes.
You're here as our science... Oh, hang on, something's happening in the sheds.
Rich, can we hit the lights?
That's Ben. It's exciting. Hi, Ben.
Oh, hello.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. I've just arrived in the shed. Where are you?
We're in the planetarium.
Oh, right, nice.
Yeah, it's cool. Have you written a poem?
Yes, yeah, finally. Just managed to finish it.
Right, what took you so long?
Well, yeah, as you know, when you first asked me to write a poem about Star Trek, I just point blank refused. I mean, what is there left to say about Star Trek after 50 years? But then you begged and begged and begged and explained that you were doing these screenings. So yeah, I had a bit of a think, and I thought, imagine you'd never seen any Star Trek before. It happens. What would you need to do? What would you need to do to prepare yourself to watch these two films? And I thought, probably what you would need to do is watch the whole of the original series and the six films, and the whole of The Next Generation and the four films. You watch the whole thing, so you've got that all in context. Probably forget the animated series, come back to that later. And then you could watch, watch these two films again for the second time and really appreciate them in the context of that whole thing. So I did a bit of research. All the numbers that I'll be using are from the internet, so probably completely inaccurate, but please don't write in with any corrections. It's the best I could do. Did some research and I came up with the number 13,227, which is the number of minutes it would take to do all that, to watch the original series and the films, to watch The Next Generation and those films. So that was the starting point of the poem.
All right, can we hear it then?
Sure. Thanks. Yeah. Okay, so 13,227 could seem like a daunting mass of minutes, but if you break it down, you'll soon get through it. It's only 7 Vulcan salutes, 34 nerve pinches, 12 mind melds, and 4 fights with the captain, who suffered 19 wardrobe malfunctions, saw 4 clones of himself, glad to hear that someone was dead, Jim, 22 times. 24 of the dead were dressed, predictably, in red, although statistically, with 9 deaths, gold shirts were a riskier bet. But after 79 episodes, a historical kiss in 1968, plus all that boldly going, those losses don't seem quite so tragic. Then there's the other captain, whose signature request was heard resonating around the bridge a Shakespearean 64 times. And his number one, the oft-bearded commander, who was known as Bill, but only on 2 occasions. Anything else to report? Well, those 10 plus 3 films, which are 77% worth watching. The non-odd ones, anyway. Not to forget the Battle of Wolf 359 and the inescapable number 47, which appears multitudinal times, perhaps more than is countable. Unless you have a positronic brain and a 100 petabyte memory, in which case, 50 years would fly by as if at warp factor 10.
Thanks, Ben. So, Tushnell,
yes.
you've come to us as our science reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Does Star Trek come up a lot when you're reporting on science?
Do you know, it's possibly the only film or TV show that we've used an actual image of in a serious article in our 25-year issue.
Really?
So yes, it really does.
Yeah.
Everyone loves it. The scientists still love it. Everyone else loves it. So yeah. Star Trek does come up a lot.
Yeah. Obviously, it's inspired a lot of scientists, but it's inspired science as well, hasn't it? I mean, we've all got communicators. But is there anything else that you've discovered in your reporting over the years?
Do you know, I decided to have a proper little look, see if I could dig it all up, and it's about 3 pages worth of things, apparently, inspired or inspired by. But before I talk about them, I talk about something I saw earlier this year. So I saw the US Orbiter Enterprise earlier this year when I was in New York. It's at the Intrepid Museum. It's really cool. You should go see it if you can. And so obviously they have an exhibit around it, and there's a little panel in there with Leonard Nimoy, so obviously veered towards it. And there was a little thing in there saying about how it got its name. And I'd never really thought about it. I thought, oh yeah, okay, Enterprise, why not? Great name. Apparently, it was going to be called Constitution. That was its official name, a very good American-sounding name for your first ever orbiter.
Yeah.
And then 400,000 fans wrote in to the then Prime President of the United States of America saying, we think it should be called Enterprise. Just to put that into perspective, that is exactly how many people also voted to have a second EU referendum. I'm just saying, it's that serious a number. And, you know, as we know, it was called Enterprise. And in fact, when the Enterprise was brought to the Intrepid, that was in 2012, its sort of final resting place, Leonard Nimoy was there to give a little speech. Apparently he reached out to NASA and said, oh, can I come and see it landing? And they said, yeah, why don't you come and see it landing and also give a little speech? He said, all right, great. So yeah, I mean, this is the kind of impact that Star Trek has had. It's beyond the gadgets even. It became such a part of the psyche of all of the people who interacted with it, especially in those days. So, okay, let's talk a little bit about all the devices, right? So, the first one, obviously, mobile phones, flip phones, Motorola got on that really well, so clearly they were hugely inspired. iPads and tablets, first seen on Star Trek. They had a whole variety of them that also kind of got shinier and nicer as the show progressed. So the older ones had tiny screens and like four big buttons, and then, you know, pretty much all the way to what we now know as an iPad was first on Star Trek. Bluetooth headsets, tapping and just starting to talk. I mean, you know, obviously they didn't call it Bluetooth, but that was Star Trek. Flat screen TVs, first on Star Trek. Big, giant, flat screens. An interesting one is the replicators. You know, that idea was really neat, and we don't quite have replicators yet, not at least not ones where you can say, can I have a cup of Earl Grey, and there you get a cup of tea.
I think Argos is the place. Argos, the shop.
Oh yeah, it is a bit, isn't it?
Sorry, carry on.
So yeah, but we've got 3D printers now that kind of do that kind of thing, and it's to the point where many people don't know that 3D printers are also used to make food. You can actually print food, things like pancakes. Can't tell you how good it tastes, don't know. but you can print your food. And in fact, that is something that NASA and Star Trek have launched, this student challenge for how you could best take something that was a replicator in Star Trek and if you could make one. And that's a competition. So check it out, take a look. I think the funding's like $50,000 if you win as a student, so that's pretty neat.
Do you know how they print food? What are they printing with to get food?
I'm not sure I remember.
With like pancakes and stuff, obviously it's already a batter.
Exactly.
So the thing, 3D printer, for those that aren't familiar, it extrudes like onto a plate, and obviously if the plate's heated, it will then start to cook the batter. So I think with pancake mix, that probably works. But other foodstuffs,
Got like some different starches and things like that that can also clump together and form.
Maybe.
Probably
it's
quite
something that's liquidy.
They do know how easy it is just to make pancakes.
Not on the ISS,
okay. No.
Yeah, doesn't it all just float away on the International Space Station?
I'm sure they have ways of holding it down.
Okay, fair enough. Sorry, carry on.
That's all right. Siri, Cortana, whatever you want to call it, different ways of talking to your computer, and Google is still working towards what they call a fully conversational computer. That's one of their main aims, so you have to stop typing in any sort of commands and you just talk to your computer, but that was obviously first on Star Trek. Universal translators, we don't quite have those yet, but we've got apps with, you know, hundreds of languages stored in them, and you can quite quickly translate. Google Glass or any kind of sort of virtual headsets and things like that. That was obviously a big thing in DS9. They really came to their own there. Phasers, that was an interesting one. I kind of looked up to see if there was any kind of phasers, and you'll not be surprised to know that the US Army does have a kind of phaser. It's called a dazzler, and it's basically a very bright laser that they use to temporarily blind people.
Okay. It's not all good then, I
guess. It's not all good, no.
Is there more?
There's more. There's more. There's more. So those are kind of the devices that Star Trek predicted. And then there's kind of like the big stuff. So search for life on other planets. You know, Star Trek kind of made it very clear that there were many planets with many different kind of terrestrial, non-terrestrial kind of planets, and we now know that to be true, especially with our recently discovered very near neighbour.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Androids and artificial intelligence, you know, thanks to data, we all know how clever they're going to be
in a couple
of centuries. Cloaking devices and obviously tractor beams, but I'll leave that to Bruce. And I guess the two other big things are, of course, the warp drive and sort of matter-antimatter annihilation, so you can travel.
Is the warp drive going to happen then?
I see, that's a big question. It is technically, mathematically possible.
Okay.
But for us to ever actually create a warp drive, we need two things. We need to discover two things. We need exotic matter, which is what it's actually called, and that was a name that first came up in Star Trek, and they decided, yeah, that sounds fine, we'll just call it exotic matter. That's a good name. And we need negative density energy.
Okay.
And if we found those two things, you know, which I'm sure just lying about.
Yeah. Bruce?
I suppose they'd float up, wouldn't they? Look up there.
Then it is slightly possible, but there's a lot of research on that. And from this initial idea of warp drives and kind of what the Enterprise and all the other ships do, which is they don't travel at light speed, they travel at faster than light speed. And they do that by actually changing the whole idea of warp. It's that they change the structure of space and time. And that is technically possible. If you basically just mess about with Einstein's field equations a little bit, it is possible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you do that, messing around with Einstein's
equations? Of course, yeah. It's just an equation. You can do whatever you like with the equation.
Good. So there is a device in this film that you didn't mention, which is the Genesis design device.
Yes.
Can anybody on the panel see why we might want one of those?
Be useful. Terraforming.
Yeah.
Quicker than Elon Musk's plan to make Mars habitable by detonating nuclear weapons above the ice caps.
Yeah.
I think that's his current plan.
Yeah. Is
as a non-scientist, I have no idea if that's a good idea.
Anyone? Seem like a good idea?
It's not a totally bad idea if you make sure that there's nothing at all on Mars and not even bacterial life form, if we can ensure that in some way, shape or form, so that you know you're not decimating anything.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a worry, isn't it? Mars could be a big letdown if
we
put all that effort to get
there
and it's basically just a pretty cold, windy, sometimes hot, windy rock.
Yeah.
I do like the fact that in such a fairly old film now, they're talking about ethical considerations and can humanity be trusted to do this sort of thing? Because we've had our fair share of mishaps.
Yeah. So would you, in your position, would you further your career by inventing a Genesis device?
I probably would say that at the moment we're not ready for that sort of thing, right?
Okay.
We've got enough problems.
Okay.
I think actually that the Genesis device was the one thing in the film that, scientifically speaking, I really disliked.
Okay.
Because there was no explanation for it. The Genesis device, you know, they normally try to explain the science or the device or what they're doing a little bit, whereas this was just a, here's this thing, it blows up. It's cool. Mm. 1 hour later, there's life.
Yeah. Although there is a lovely sequence with the Genesis device being shown in the film.
Oh yeah, the video that they watched, that was the first completely CGI created sequence ever done. I think ILM did it. But that was the first time an entire sequence had been done in the computer. So yeah, I mean, for a special effects point of view, Star Trek II broke that mold. I do have a science question, though.
Oh, cool.
How bad of a scientist would Chekhov have to be to not notice that there are five planets in the system and not six? I mean, you would have thought, as just general scientists go, it's like, wasn't there meant to be another planet? We lost a planet. And can a planet just explode?
Should we get a mathematician in for
someone,
the next
episode? Yeah, I mean,
it's interesting. I guess it depends on how it happened. in that if somehow, you know, the one that explodes completely disintegrates, and then the other one falls into the previous one's orbit, then you could be fooled into believing it was the original planet.
Hmm.
Okay.
I have a tangent, Andrew.
Okay, go for it.
So I'm concerned with the rate of progress compared to what Star Trek, the original series, was predicted there. They mentioned 1996 in there, which was 10 years ago now.
20 years ago.
You're a scientist!
There we go.
That's how he did it.
That's really scary. Is anyone else scared by that fact?
Do you not remember the great eugenics wars of 1990? What a time to be alive, that was.
Just the brainwashing that followed. But it seems that any sci-fi always sort of mispredicts, underpredicts the rate that things are happening at. Is that something that's sort of common in? I don't know where I'm going with that. It's a tangent.
You mean things like Space Odyssey and stuff like that? Where,
yeah.
That's even gone, wasn't it?
15 years ago, got on. Right, okay.
Or actual hoverboards that probably hover.
Yeah. That's a stupid name. Yeah.
Well, I think to get to the utopian vision of Star Trek, we still have to go through a Third World War, so...
Come on, President Trump!
I've interviewed this week Lynn Rothschild from NASA, who's an astrobiologist, and she's just talking completely as if we're going to Mars, we're going to do it. And she got quite upset when I said, you wouldn't be doing these experiments. I might put the interview on this podcast, not sure, it'll be on something at some point. You're all going to be regular listeners now, so it's fine, you're here. And I said to her, you wouldn't be doing these experiments, would you? NASA wouldn't be doing these experiments. She's got an experiment going up, which is testing growing food in Earth gravity, then the Moon gravity, and then Mars's gravity. You wouldn't be doing that, would you? And she said, no, of course we wouldn't. I get really upset when people ask me that question, because it's not, are we going to Mars? It's when we're going to Mars. And are we going in our lifetime? And I think we all know that the only thing that's stopping us is the desire to do it. And it's politicians getting in the way. And I just cross about that.
Why are you looking at me when you said that?
Because you're the only person who's not a scientist.
I'm in charge of funding.
Anyway, that's the thing. So, we've got a question from the audience through Twitter, which is very exciting. It's the first time that's ever happened. it's a good one. It comes from Halapeng. Are you here still? No, that's fine. assuming transporters were in regular everyday use, what's the laziest thing you would regularly transport yourself to? I'll give the panel a chance to think about it by answering myself. I live in Bishopston, at the top of a hill, and the corner shop is at the bottom of the hill. So that's an easy answer for me. I just transport down there for milk and croissant every morning. Croissants, if you will, I don't know. And Maddie?
I feel like I'd be even lazier than that. I'd probably just transport downstairs to my fridge.
Okay. What's in the fridge?
Hopefully, some chocolate or something like that.
Okay.
Not very exciting, but...
I'd be even lazier and just beam the stuff out of the fridge and straight.
I'm not moving.
Do you want a research job?
I'm in.
That sort of thinking.
Steve?
Even lazier, bed to bathroom in the middle of the night.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You're that stage, aren't you? Toshner?
I was thinking transport a long distance, you know, I'd be like, ooh, weekend break in New Zealand.
That's not too lazy, though. That's just good thinking. Bruce?
Things like popping to the newsagent to get a newspaper or going to get some milk, that really irritates me. I think that would be a good one to circumvent with a transporter, I think.
Sounds like a good plan. Which newspaper are you getting?
I can transport to your house as well and deliver yours as well.
Okay, yes, please. Yeah, that's fine. I just don't want the mail. That's fine. Or the Express, to be fair. Or the Mirror. Actually.
I thought we banned politics.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
It's usually the Beano.
The other one's for you, Bruce. I'll do that in a bit. I have a question for the panel, which is, if you were to go on a 5-year mission with anyone from the Star Trek universe, any of the characters, who would it be and why? I'll give you time again. So my answer would be 7 of 9.
You're very predictable.
Because she has assimilated all the knowledge of all those species from the Borg. So
conversation.
She'd know a lot, and that's why. Tag?
I'd go with Guinan. She tends bar. She listens. I'm a very simple person. In fact, she tends bar.
Yeah.
5 years.
She also knows an awful lot of stuff.
She does.
Yeah.
She'd be a good guy.
She's pretty good.
She tends bar.
Yeah. Yeah. Bruce.
Well, I mean, I don't think I want to go away for all that time. So I'd be some of that time I'd be away, but most of the time I'd probably be doing what I do, researching.
Yeah.
And I think that's where Spock would come in pretty useful. That sort of logic could just cut through to the answers, perhaps.
Yeah.
So I could just sit back and he would, I don't know, he could be a dubious sort of helper, couldn't he? But
yeah, I think he'd be pretty good.
I thought he'd be a good answer, but then I started thinking, actually, there are quite a few people you find in academia that are a bit Spock-like anyway. Do we need another one? But it'd be good to have the real thing. You know, he really, really was completely logical. So when I thought I wanted to do an experiment just because it would be fun, he'd tell me that was utterly stupid and illogical, I suppose.
Yeah.
And this is what you should be doing instead.
Yeah. Do you ever do an experiment just for fun?
Yeah.
Okay, all the time?
Yeah, basically.
Is that where this comes from?
This comes as a result of many experiments done for fun.
Okay.
Amazing. And an interest in Star Trek, so.
Cool.
Combined. Cool. Colliding.
Yeah. Steve?
I would go with anyone in a red shirt because it would exponentially increase my likelihood of coming back.
Okay. Yeah, good answer. As long as you're not in gold. And Madeline?
I think I'd have to go for Scotty.
Okay.
Yeah, just because the accent would be quite entertaining.
Yeah.
But also, I feel like he'd be able to get me out of tight situations that require engineering.
Cool. Okay, which one? Simon Pegg or that one?
Probably Simon Pegg.
And you, that's why I asked. And Tushner.
It's going to be really boring and say Kirk.
Okay.
Because, you know, Captain, I'm not going anywhere without him. And then when he comes, the posse will follow, so it's all good.
Yeah.
I did have a second option. I thought it'd be nice to see Kirk running my department. I think that would be quite fun.
Yeah.
Something completely mundane. Well, how would he handle that?
I don't think it's completely mundane what you do, Bruce.
What I do isn't, of course, but most of the other people in the department. Probably all avid listeners of the Cosmos Show.
Thanks, Bruce. The only problem I've got with the film is that Khan is supposed to have a genetically engineered better intelligence, and he's a moron, isn't he?
I think, don't they say in Space Seed that superior intellect breeds superior ambition? So it's not a case of, no, it's a case of he's really smart, but he's really egotistical. And that's how Kirk beats him, by playing to his ego.
Yeah.
We have all been done by ego before.
Have we?
Well.
We have a tractor beam in the room with us. This is, I believe, the first time this has ever been shown outside the lab, is that right?
Yes.
You are
yes.
Welcome, Bristol.
So,
if it all goes wrong.
So at this point, Bruce started demonstrating the sonic tractor beam. It's amazing. You should really check it out. We'll post a video of it on the website. But here's an interview that I did with Bruce separately.
We created the world's first tractor beam. The first sonic tractor beam, should I say. There's been attempts to do optical tractor beams previously, but ours is a sonic tractor beam, which has got many advantages over optical tractor beams. So the amount of energy we need to get a given amount of tracting force is a lot better than optical systems. So our system uses tiny little loudspeakers that are basically parking sensors, not a high-powered laser death ray. So you could easily have it here in front of us, and it would do us no harm whatsoever. it's an array of loudspeakers. It's about as big as a small dinner plate. It's made up of something like 100 little loudspeakers. Each one is actually a parking sensor because we're in the ultrasonic range. They're loudspeakers, but they're loudspeakers that you can't hear the sound of. So parking sensors, they output sound, ultrasound, and you can detect how far away the neighbouring car is. But they broadcast sound, and the real trick behind it is how to drive these loudspeakers in such a way as to create a tractor beam. The key to it is to generate this 3D sound field that has these trapping properties. And in a nutshell, the key behind that is to try and create a region that's really quiet, surrounded by a region that's really loud. In these quiet regions, they're stable regions, and to imagine a particle, or you, if you like, if it could be scaled up to human size, you're in this quiet region, and in any direction that you move, you hit this wall of really loud sound that pushes you back into the quiet region. So our device creates this 3D landscape.
It creates both the quiet and the loud.
Exactly, and critically, it has to be, to get a tractor beam to be stable in three dimensions, this has to be a three-dimensional pattern of sound. Mm-hmm. So that, or we showed that there were three different patterns that create patterns of acoustic energy, acoustic intensity, that create stable acoustic tractor beams. One of them is that the acoustic field looks rather like a pair of fingers, another one looks like a vortex, a hurricane twisting around, and the other one looks like a cage. If we're using this version that we create, like a 3D sphere of high pressure sound around the object, then that 3D cage is being moved around. Because the loudspeakers are all outputting slightly different sound fields, and the field, this acoustic field, follows what we tell it to do via the loudspeakers.
I'm watching Star Trek, and we need to get a ship docked with the Enterprise. I can see that that's an application for it. Probably not yet, but it's possible that that might be something in the future. But that's not why you've invented it.
It isn't, and I have to own up to a deficiency of our system, which is that sound waves don't propagate in space.
Ah.
So those spaceships that you just described would have to be within the Earth's atmosphere for it to work like this. So I'm not saying this is what happens, but how do people get abducted from the Earth and taken up to alien spacecraft? I think that all happens, as much as it does happen, within the atmosphere. But if you're talking about in space, this isn't the technology for space applications. Okay. Unless they also push out a load of gas to allow these waves to propagate. So there has to be something there, a gas, a liquid, or a solid. Obviously, that's not really a tractor beam. If you put a solid, that's an arm coming to grab you.
But so what are the applications?
What we've done is on a relatively small scale to what you described. So the objects we've been tracting are 3 or 4 millimeters in diameter, so really small as a sort of small garden pea. So there are applications, I think, at round about that sort of length scale, in terms of manufacturing small and delicate objects. So if you wanted to move pharmaceutical products, a small pill that you might take is round about that sort of size, there'd be a production line but without a conveyor belt, in essence, and that would be very, very clean. There'd be no moving parts to clean, and so you could minimize contamination. You could also imagine a similar argument could be made if the material was dangerous, avoiding contamination with humans and avoiding the need to clean things. Personally, I'm more excited by a different scale, a smaller scale, so going the opposite direction to the large scale sci-fi dream, but actually going to a smaller scale thing, which also forms part of sci-fi, about manipulating, for example, small objects like tiny drug capsules within the human body, delivering drugs to very targeted locations, and then maybe even blasting the drug capsules open with ultrasound, or even moving tiny surgical instruments or other things like that might be required to, say, reconstruct the interior of some damaged organ. You can potentially have some huge impact on biology, and therefore in the future health. And it's kind of these are like the sort of the new generation of tools that I suppose researchers in biomedicine will use to make the next generation of breakthroughs. Things can move quickly if there's a real medical need. If you seem to be solving a problem. The good news is ultrasound is actually quite heavily used in medicine already from an imaging perspective, breaking up stones, kidney stones and the like perspective. So there's a whole lot of applications that already made it through. So if we can piggyback off that technology, then it might be easier to persuade the powers that be to tractor beams in the human body could be a headline of the future. And I'd love to be the person that does the work, or even involved with the team that does the work to make that a reality, because I think it's hugely important.
And we go back to the planetarium now for one last question from the audience.
I was just wondering if you could pick up a marshmallow and have it melted and cooked by the time it got to you.
Hey!
Well, you've answered a better answer than mine to the question. You tweeted in. That's a fantastic idea.
Well, I think we'll end it there. Thank you so much to everybody here. Thank you to the panel, Ty, Maddie, Steve, Tushner, and Professor Bruce Drinkwater. And thank you for listening.
The Cosmic Show.
Science Fact.
Science Fiction.
And everything in between.